Welcome to The Rippling Pages, a podcast on the craft of writing, created and crafted by me, Liam Bishop. Today, I'm delighted to be joined by Marianne Brooker. Now, we love the essay form on The Rippling Pages, and we love the Fitzcarraldo Essay Prize. This is a prize that Marianne's book, Intervals, has won. It's a book about Marianne and her mother. In 2009, Marianne's mother was diagnosed with primary progressive multiple sclerosis. The progression of the disease made it increasingly difficult for Marianne's mother to live, for she took the decision to stop eating and drinking, a voluntary act of dying on her own terms. Marianne charts that journey, both her own and her mother's. In the book and along the way, she confronts the philosophy of what is not only a good life, but a good death, and if such a thing is possible. Anne Boyer, Maggie Nelson, D.W. Winnicott, Annie Ernaux, among many, many others are referenced and read by Marianne. It is, expectedly, a heartbreaking read, but there is a latent fierceness to the writing as Marianne confronts, and asks us to confront, the politics of caring and care, and the potentially unequal rights of death. Marianne, thank you so much for joining me. How are we doing?
Yeah, I'm doing very well. Thank you. Thanks for having me on as well.
It is nominated for the Women's Prize for Nonfiction. Thanks for being here. And I realise that this book has, as we've sort of alluded to there, got lots of coverage, and it's been... you've been busy with lots of events, so it is really nice for you to give up your time. Obviously, I've given a bit of a introduction there, but I'd like to sort of know when you decided that to put this on the page. When did you start to think, this is a book that I want to write?
In the months after my mum died, I did a little bit of campaigning around the right to die, and I've always done kind of stuff around anti-austerity, anti-cut stuff. But kind of, I found narrative that you employ when you're doing campaigning, the kind of tactics that you're using are necessarily quite targeted, quite key message, like single issue type things. And I found that was just insufficient for thinking about how complex my mum's story was, and how, I guess, I wanted to be talking about choice in a way that was really rooted in a social context and that was really true to both the particularity and intimacy of the time that I shared with my mum at the end of her life, but also that situated her in a wider, I don't know, wider communities of practice around how she worked and how she crafted and the kinds of world that she was living in. So I felt like I was trying to talk with people about it, but like butting up against not having the space or not having the time, or like not being able to make the connections that I wanted to make. So I did that for a little while and then kind of took a break. And then as I was researching it and editing it, actually towards the end, I was looking through some old hard drives and I found some like scraps and snippets of writing I'd done years before, like 5-6 years before my mum had died, that had little just tiny turns of phrases that I'd written before that appear in the book, but I'd totally forgotten that they had that kind of earlier genesis.
What was that period of time like between submitting it and having the proposal and the actual sort of the act of then of, right, you've got the go ahead green light? What I'm asking is, would you have written this book anyway?
I would like to think that I would have done. But it's hard to know, because I think it's a different kind of discipline, I think, writing, not knowing what the home for the writing will be, and then writing knowing that you've got a deadline. I had a really supportive editor. I had a kind of arc where I knew, I guess, how to set the pace, because you write in different ways, I think, at the beginning and in the middle and towards the deadline of a project. And so I felt really kind of supported and spurred by knowing that I had a green light. And as I say, there was a year or so before I was trying and failing and circling and avoiding, and I probably would have done that for a bit longer had I not got the go-aheads there.
Politics in there, there's memoir, there is literary criticism. How would you sort of categorize it or not categorize it?
I guess, although I've maybe felt a bit ambivalent towards it at the beginning, I find the Fitzcarraldo gloss of it being an essay kind of helpful, even though, I mean, perhaps not in terms of other people understanding what I mean, because I feel like most people would just have essay in their mind as like something that you write when you're at school. But I think because it's that blend of memoir and polemic and philosophy and criticism and lots of things, that they combine in a kind of, I guess, like meditation, or like, I don't know, it has an argument. Like, I think at each point in the writing and in editing the chapters and kind of refining the arc of each chapter, I was trying to test the writing against whether it was serving the purpose of like helping me to understand and situate this theme of choice and the kind of associated themes of care and creativity. So I think essay is helpful for me, though not helpful because it's not that widely used a term, maybe. I think probably there's, I don't know, I feel like writers and critics are always like inventing and setting up genres for the purposes of then disobeying their rules. And I think that's probably happening here a little bit too, that it's like, it's drawing on the lineages and like contexts of things like memoir and journalism and philosophy, but also blurring the edges a little bit as well.
It's obviously innovative. It's obviously trying to do some things whilst also addressing this difficult subject matter. But when, you know, I'm thinking here of, obviously I've mentioned, I know I've mentioned some writers in the start. The kind of, you mentioned there's this sort of line of philosophy and political philosophy and political critique around choice. And it kind of reminds me of books like Alice Hattrick's Ill Feelings, which you do mention in the book, Sam Mills' Fragments of My Father. But even sort of going back to the kind of writing about, you know, the mother as a subject, like Roland Barthes and that kind of thing. Your mother is obviously central to it, but she's also kind of, but she kind of, she also enables you to write about all these, so many kind of different things. Did these, were these emerging in the writing of the book, or were they kind of coming through? Did you sort of plan it, these different routes in?
No, I did not plan it. I'm not much of a planner, kind of to a fault or to my shame. I'm definitely, I guess the planning that I did was actually kind of visual. I like, when I was putting the proposal together, I had a bit of a crazy professor moment where I put these big bits of paper on my bedroom wall and I drew out this timeline of scenes or kind of vignettes that I wanted to explore, where my mum really was at the center of them. And then underneath I plotted stuff that I've read or ideas I wanted to explore, or concepts that I wanted to draw out and how they could match onto some of the scenes. And then through the writing found that some of those things came out really easily and just worked. Some of those things didn't work at all and it was a bit false. Some of those things bred new things that I hadn't thought about. And I tried as much as I could to let that, I don't know, let those things emerge organically rather than being too constrained by a plan from the beginning. And I think, yeah, you're totally right that like at points, I feel like my mum in the book is a bit of a center of gravity. So I'm always orbiting her in some way. But sometimes looking in other directions and like trying to be quite upfront about how it's not an effort at like amplifying her voice or things that she thought she had. Like there's not really any reported speech in the book. It's very much my perspective on her and what it's like as someone who loved her, as a daughter, as a caregiver, looking in on her and spending time with her. Like, what is it like to live with, to be with, rather than like it being a kind of platform for her thoughts and feelings, because I just can't kind of propose to do that because I'm not her. She had multiple sclerosis for a decade before she died. And that whole time she had thought about and campaigned on what control or autonomy at the end of life could look like. Also in the context of doing loads of campaigning against cuts and austerity. Also, I guess like before that point, I write in the book a little bit about her CV, which is like a document that I've got in my desk, and what that path can reveal about her kind of perspective and character from my perspective. And I don't know, trying to trace like where her perspective on this is rooted in, like her work with trade unions before she got sick, her work with communities and young people, like all of these things kind of snowballing to give her a particular perspective on, I don't know, autonomy in a more social context.
It's a very short book. It's not very short, but it's a short book, isn't it? And but it's full, it's brimming, isn't it? There's so much in there. There's so much emotion. There's so much. There's so many different modes and registers. And there's so much of you and your mother's life. And it is a remarkable piece of work, in that way, intimately tied up into your mother's life and writing about your mother's life, and intimately tied up into the issues of the politics of what's happened, you know, with your mother. And think about your work as a writer. Does it feel like you're finding a voice within this? You're finding your own way through this, your own choice, your own kind of narrative?
Yeah, definitely. And that feels quite fluid rather than fixed. I think, yeah, finding a voice rather than feeling like I've got one and I just need a platform for it. I guess some of that is kind of live in the moment of the story I'm writing about, or like with my mum learning a kind of coming up with our own vocabulary to talk about these things in the moment, because there aren't, I don't know, when I first kind of found out that she wanted to stop eating and drinking, that felt very shocking to me in the first instance, because it's just not something I had heard or thought about. And so we kind of had to combine, I guess, the registers of like our own intimate, particular ways of talking, and then like reading medical papers and trying to understand what this would look like, and then finding a way of talking to other friends about it, finding a way of talking to doctors about it, and then in the aftermath of her death, feeling like I'd done all of this thinking and talking in the private context of a family or in a caregiving context, and still found myself wanting to talk about it and wanting to find people to talk with about it, and going to a kind of a variety of sources to do that, or genres to do that.
It kind of it feels like, and you alluded it to it just before then, but it feels like it, as you like you said, there was a kind of an orbit, and it kind of makes me think of this. It feels like a book. There's so many different kind of, and the only word I could sort of come up with was forces. There's so much kind of there's a kind of it's as if you're sort of trying to find or explore something quite essential, and I don't know what that is. I don't know what the term for it is, but there's a kind of an essence. You know, there's creativity. There's life, there is death. And it, obviously your mother, she feels like this kind of a force, a central force within the book.
Yeah, definitely. As you're talking, it reminds me of there's a book I talk about a lot in intervals called Women Who Run With The Wolves, which was my mum's favorite book. And it was kind of in our house all the time, like announcing itself very vividly. She had this massive poster with a big quotation from it, and she painted a quotation from it on her wardrobe, and she read it all the time. And I hadn't ever read it myself. I'm not sure what the why that was. Until she was dying, and she asked me to read her something while we were in bed, and I read her a passage from the introduction, initially thinking I would just work my way through the whole of the book, and then stuck on that passage of the introduction and just read it to her again and again and again over the days, because it's describing this like force of the wild woman and how that exists in relation to nature, but also in a really like materialist political way in relation to institutions and communities and like kind of social things. And I was so struck in that book by how, I don't know, the way that it depicts something that is reaching towards something that's a bit universal or essential, I suppose, but in ways that just felt like every single line I could say, oh, that's my mum, like the muddy fox, and the kind of talking about schools and prisons, and talking about plants in the way that she does it. Every particularity seems to resonate with this like force that my mum has, that is both like, I don't know, I was quite interested in the book in exploring like how kind of hard social conditions relate to like harder to pin down perhaps spirituality, perhaps essence, perhaps, I don't know, I'm not sure what the right words for it are, but the interactions between these two things, the kind of the power that each of those aspects have.
There's the film that reminded me of, and the person that reminded me of, Chantal Ackerman, No Home movie, where she's very different circumstances, but it's about her mother. I don't know if you've seen it or know it.
I do know it. I didn't make reference to the film while I was writing, but I did read what I think of as a kind of companion text,
Okay.
which is The Laughs by Chantal Ackerman, which is the last text that she wrote, and is kind of about the same thing. It's her observations of her mother and her experiences of being with her mother running up to her death. And there are lots of things in there that were provocations for thought for me, that she describes her dog dying, she describes watching her mother laugh and the significance of the laugh in the context of age and illness and care, and lots of things that I had this experience with many books that kind of spurred me to think, oh, this thing that's just an everyday thing that's lying around, these flowers, this laugh, this stain on the carpet is actually a really significant thing that I can write about as well.
That's it. I think it's that everydayness, the quotidianness of it that I find so compelling, that it is within the daily rhythms and rituals, which kind of feels like your book is to some extent, and how you have to sort of manage your kind of daily life and how it changes with the requirements and the changing circumstances. But it's also, and I felt this in that film, there is so much external, I don't know what you call it, context. It speaks more. You kind of see in a not a nutshell, but you see in a very sort of kernel of this relationship so much more, so many more different dynamics. And that's why, for me, there's so much poetry, there's so much beauty to this book.
Although the focus is, I don't know, I am a daughter and she was my mother, so that is the primary relationship I'm exploring. I also didn't want to limit the view to that or kind of elevate that above other types of relationships that were also at play. So I guess it's also about friendship. It's also about the relationship with agency carers. It's also about, in weird ways, her relationship with her pot plants and her chicken and her dog, or like, I don't know, the kind of really densely woven fabric of social relations. And I was like a part of that, but we were existing within this web of other relationships simultaneously as well.
There is a moment where you say, my mum and I were the makers of one another. Sophie Lewis. Well, she says something quite a lot. We are the makers of one another. It is those truths that I wish to call real surrogacy. And then you say, my mum and I were the makers of one another, which is what Sophie said to finish that quote. But then you qualify that by saying, we were the unmakers too. But I don't know if you were able to explain that a bit more, or I was just quite interested in that idea, just because it seems to feed into quite a lot of other ideas when you go into things like the kind of roles that you have in what, you know, with your mother.
Yeah, for sure. Maybe to contextualize that a little bit. So I'm drawing on Sophie Lewis's book on surrogacy and feminism against the family. And she, that was a really formative moment in my thinking about the book, actually, in that I can't remember when she put that book out, but I went to see the launch at the LRB bookshop, and my mum had died not that long before. It was one of the first kind of events that I went to. So I was still kind of slightly fizzing with everything. And I was listening to Sophie talk about surrogacy beyond its kind of commercial frameworks, to thinking about how we can, I guess, like stand by and in for one another, and like what a radical form of surrogacy might look like. And at heart, that felt to me to resonate with ideas about assistance. And I guess I'd been thinking a lot about assistance in relation to dying and end of life care and what that could look like. And she gave me a kind of, without realizing it or intending to, a bit of a framework to think about how I could talk about it in a more radical way than the quite individualizing and liberalizing ways in which we can often talk about assistance and the right to die. And I remember listening to Sophie talk about it, and then on my cycle home, which was like an hour, I was like stopping every 10 minutes to note stuff down on my phone because I was just like bubbling with ideas. It really like set me off, I think, on wanting to write this. And then in the book where I add that qualification about unmaking, I think I'm maybe pressing on the contradiction of what it was to care for my mum through that period, in that we were fulfilling a wish that she had, that she wanted to die as much as possible in her own time, in her own home, on her own terms. But the contradiction there is that the fulfillment of that wish is that she died, which is the most dissembling, untake backable thing. And it does feel like an unmaking, like you see in very, very concrete ways a person ending and falling apart. And it just feels, I don't know, such a powerful juxtaposition as like a kind of assisting, living with, caring for, but that that unmakes someone in the same moment.
Perhaps for listeners, would you be comfortable sort of just explaining, so your mum gets primary progressive multiple sclerosis, would you be comfortable explaining what that is?
Yeah, sure. It's a neurological condition that is very notoriously difficult to diagnose. So she took a kind of quite a long time of experiencing symptoms before she got the diagnostic test, which is an MRI scan. I write in the book about, I guess, like one, the kind of like medical misogyny around that, how it's like doctors often don't believe women who report symptoms like these, especially when they could be related to like any number of conditions. And also about how the onset of those physical symptoms related to a change in our social circumstances as well, that she got sick and then she lost her job and then we lost our home, and those things compound to one another. MS has very like unpredictable paths. It's hard to know exactly, like kind of it looks different for different people. For her, it meant things over the course of a decade, like in the end not being able to walk, the loss of the use of different parts of her body, her hands and her feet at different points, intense pain, fatigue, gradually kind of slurred speech, occasional loss of vision. Like it, because it's a neurological thing, it can manifest in the body in any number of ways. And she decided to hasten her death by stopping eating and drinking at a point where I think she was concerned not only about the immediate suffering that she was experiencing because of her symptoms and because of her social condition, but also how that might get worse in the future and how she might lose the capacity to articulate her wishes and advocate for herself.
Thanks, Annie. I'm going to have a quick break, but come right back and we'll talk more to Annie about intervals. Thanks for joining Marianne and I on the Rippling Pages. Why not grab yourself a coffee and join us for the second half of the conversation? The toll that obviously is put on you and your mother must have been, which we obviously see in the book, how did you chart the progression of that and make sense about who you are and sort of who your role in this was with your mother?
One of the things that I'm trying to do and how I articulate choice in the book is think about how it's always conditioned by circumstance to varying degrees, or like how we can both honor one's volition and agency and power, which I think was there with my mum, but in such a way that doesn't deny structurally how the world's set up to limit our choices. And so I think in relation to myself, that's a play too, that like I was in my late teens when my mum was diagnosed. I guess kind of I don't know, through the years where she had MS, balancing like making a life for myself while also wanting to enjoy the time we had together and spend time continuing to get to know one another and experience one another creatively and lovingly, and also how to I guess mutually how to provide for one another, like helping with money, helping with care on the home, helping connect her with agency care and working out benefits things, and I don't know, the whole suite of what you would expect, I guess, from that kind of relationship. And the kind of push and pull of that, and like points where I really tried to rise to that points, obviously, where there's confusion and difficulty around that too, that there it's kind of a process of constant negotiation with oneself and with the other person and with the conditions in which we found ourselves.
Does it feel like your relationship changes at all when something like this is happening?
One of the things I try to describe in the book is a sense of how our care for one another did feel reciprocal, that you're always simultaneously caring and cared for, loving and loved, stressed and stressing someone else out. Like there's always an interplay. And I think, I guess that feels very important to the argument of the book, in that I didn't want to frame my mum's dependency as a drain in the way that it can be framed in kind of wider discourse, that dependency is just it's a fact of the human condition in loads of ways. And to be, I don't know, what does it look like to properly hold that interdependence rather than resist it or demonize it or hold it in contempt? I think as my mum's condition deteriorated, there were some things about our relationship that may remain totally constant, that I was always her daughter and she was always the mum, and we always had our like quite unique ways of relating to one another. And obviously also it shifted or intensified because I had to take on more responsibility for more things or learn more things.
I don't really know if this is a question, Annie, but I'd just quite like to say it's the moment where you find the video of your mother. And I think this is after she's died. And it's just it's but I'll be surprised if I read something. So I just the poetry of it, the philosophy of it, the emotion of it, the craft, and I don't know how intentional that was, but it just seemed to bring this book together, and it just felt like I don't know, I don't want to, I've got to be, I want, I'm trying to be really careful here, but it just felt like you were giving room to your sort of your mother speaking to us. She's speaking to the reader. She's you found this footage of her and she's speaking to us.
I think I wrote that at the beginning of a residency, so that the Fitzcarraldo Essay Prize comes with some time away in Italy to write. I noticed that in the first couple of days, I kind of went to my desk and I think I set out a book by Carolyn Steedman, the historian, a book by Annie Arnaud, a book by Simone de Beauvoir about caring for her mum. And I had these in front of me and I started to write about them. And then I caught myself and I thought, oh, you're writing an essay, or you're like defaulting to this quite academic way of engagement, that mode of engagement that is not, it's not really how I wanted to enter into this project. And then I thought, well, what do I make the point of reference, or where do I start from if not here? How do I bring this closer to home? And then I reflected on a moment a couple months before of finding this video of my mum and watched it again and started to write about it. And I think it's the only part of the book where she kind of speaks through the text. And yeah, they kind of mapping over one another the experience, like what she's saying, with the experience of watching it, with the question of what it's like to, I don't know, put this archive of materials together. There's also a lot of photographs in the book that I talk about. I guess the yearning for like finding more things like that, that the sheer rush of finding a video and of someone who has died and like hearing their voice was just like such a incredibly powerful experience, but also one that has, I don't know, kind of weirdly diminishing returns, in that I found that I just watched it absolutely obsessively and then you harden yourself to it a little bit, or it never has quite the same feeling as the first time that you find it. And so I'm kind of writing about repetition and encounter and grief.
It's even speaking about it, it's so powerful feeling that you get sort of hearing about it as well. It's around this idea of you say that you learn that the filmmakers might have raw footage or rushes of, and I think you sort of, then you talk about how that could be sort of moments of your mother laughing, like outtakes. And it just felt like, but it just felt like that was kind of what this book was as well. There was these moments of presentation. You were presenting to us these moments of, you were articulating, you were sort of giving us a narrative, but then also you're doing your best to make room for the reality of someone's life, which is not just, it's beyond the disease, beyond the situation. The kind of the outtakes felt like that's the real, not, it just felt like it's moments of people that we don't always see, I guess, but the book was placing a lot of privilege to that, I guess.
Yeah, definitely. There's an interesting, I guess, when I'm talking about her wanting to find a video that I never found, they don't have the outtakes that I hope they had, of her laughing, is also is thinking about that Chantal Ackerman book that we were talking about before, that she kind of describes her mum's laugh, and my mum's laugh just feels so, I can picture it more clearly than any other part or moment of her, but I don't have evidence of it. And like sitting with a bunch of materials in their gaps, and like what you do with gaps in a kind of assemblage of materials that represent or testify to someone's life, and how Sadia Hartman writes really brilliantly about the archive and its gaps, and how you kind of can imagine into stories that aren't told or impossible stories, what you do with them without romanticizing them or glossing over those ruptures, but also taking them as a as an opportunity to imagine what could have been and what could be, that like that also becomes part of the political project of the book, like the making room for the things that don't exist and the wishing for the things that exist, and how, I don't know, that what direction you orient that desire, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. And it's making me think there's a thread throughout the book about reality, or not, it's not reality, but it's real. What is real? What is not real? How does creativity tie into real? You start the book talking about this fairy tale, the Velveteen Rabbit, which is about toys that come to life.
Mm-hmm.
And this thread sort of maintains its way through. And just thinking about this moment here, you know, this idea of, sorry to sort of labor this point, but raw footage, I just really like this phrase. What, you know, what is, and thinking about the book now as this thing, this object in the world, you know, how does it feel like to, you know, what does real represent, I guess, is what I'm asking you. What is real? What is reality when sort of doing something like this?
I think maybe what I came to is a sense that the limits of the real are quite contingent, that what we take to be most real, most inevitable, most commonplace is a made thing and can be unmade or remade in different ways. I think that's the point that I'm trying to make, and that then the catalyst for that remaking at the level of interpersonal relationships and at the level of social systems can start with an imaginative act, that we kind of see beyond the limits that we're told to obey. And through the book, that's kind of operating for my mum and her relationship to fantasy and play, and never, I don't know, like not accepting the limits that are placed upon her, always imagining beyond them. And so wanting to apprehend the real in concrete and honest terms, but also to refuse unnecessary limits, I suppose.
What's a lovely way to describe someone, and describe this book, but also just to describe someone. Marianne Brooker, thank you for coming on to the Rippling Pages and talking about you, talking about your mother, talking about the book. It is, I don't need to say this now, for listeners who've come this far with us, but it is a beautiful book. The book is out now. It's published by Fitzcarraldo Editions. But for now, Marianne, thank you very much for joining me on the Rippling Pages podcast.
Thank you.